Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Ever since the states began implementing stay-at-home orders in March, almost every link in the food supply chain has been strained. Farmers have to bury crops and dump milk because restaurants can't buy the goods. Meat processing plants have been dealing with hundreds of ill workers. Grocery stores have struggled to keep basics on the shelves. And food banks are seeing a jump in demand, but are seeing fewer donations. Now, there have been some people who have put together the dots, connecting the glut of food with charities and working to connect the need to the supply. But the solutions are not coming quickly enough. Joining me now to look at how the coronavirus outbreak is affecting our food from farm to table is Laura Riley. She writes about the business of food for The Washington Post. Laura, welcome to All of It.
Thanks for having me today.
So let's start at the beginning of the food supply chain. Let's start at farms. Now, farmers obviously have had a rough couple of years, but you know what? They were preparing to have a great 2020. Why were farmers preparing for high demand for their crops in 2020?
Well, we were seeing increases in prices for meat across the board. They'd had a couple terrible years in terms of weather events that decimated crops, made it hard to plant, made it hard to harvest. So projections were that this was going to be a turnaround for a number of row crops, et cetera. So a lot of that got scuttled by COVID-19, unfortunately.
Now, how much aid has been secured to help farmers so far during the coronavirus outbreak?
Well, so we were coming into this with two different tranches of aid because of trade wars. So we had $16 billion and $14 billion to farmers that were affected by trade issues. And now, as of the beginning of April, there were $19 billion additional dollars allocated for farmers who've been affected by COVID-19. 16 in direct financial assistance, and then 3 in the purchase of product for those for dairy, for the meat, and then for specialty crops for fruit and veg.
Why are farmers having to take these drastic measures like dumping milk and euthanizing animals?
Well, so it really is kind of dependent upon the sector of the industry that we're talking about. So let's take a few in a row here. So vegetables, this time of year, most of the veg that you get in the grocery store, let's take Whole Foods, Safeway, whatever, a lot of that comes from Mexico this time of year. Okay. The California farmers and the Florida farmers that have product this early in the season mostly sell into food service. Those are the avenues that they have. And it's a really bifurcated system. So if you're selling your product, your, Florida tomatoes from Immokalee, to food service, it goes through U.S. Foods or Sysco. It doesn't have any kind of avenue at the grocery stores, at a retail situation. So when all restaurants closed, all of those farmers who traditionally sell into food service had nowhere to sell their product. Those slots are already taken with Mexico, Mexican product this time of year. So that's what happens there. And then you have things like the meat industry, and that's pork, chicken, and beef. You had enormous outbreaks of COVID-19 in the meat processing facilities. So we have plenty of animals on the farm side, and we have plenty of need on the retail side. The bottleneck was in those processing plants. And then dairy, and an interesting thing about dairy is 50% of cheese, 60% of butter are sold to food service, and then about 7 or 8% of fluid milk is sold into school lunches. And the quantities that they sell those in, if you think about it, it's very hard to pivot to retail if you're talking about those little cute 8-ounce milks that they sell it for school lunch. And then on the restaurant side, butter in 10-pound blocks does not do a home unless you're doing some really weird stuff at home, it really doesn't do you that much good, those kind of quantities. So yeah. Some of the mismatch or the problems that we were seeing, the idea that the farmers are not able to get rid of their product, but yet there are holes in the grocery store. Some of that is that the packaging size is inappropriate for retail.
My guest is Laura Riley. She covers the food industry for The Washington Post. We're talking about the different problems along the way in the food chain. So let's talk about those meat processing plants for just a minute. I think a lot of people are wondering, why are we so reliant on these meat processing plants? Why are we more reliant than ever before?
Well, it all kind of goes back to the Secretary of Ag maybe 30 years ago, Earl Butz, who kind of had this like get big or get out mentality. And so farms across the board from, you know, soy and corn to dairy to meat got larger, got consolidated, larger and larger and larger. So if you have a processing plant that is able to, let's say beef, you know, that's able to process 5,000 head of cattle a day, if that processing plant goes down, that's a very large percentage of the day's beef nationally. So the problem has been consolidation. Obviously, it's more efficient. You know, it's more lucrative for the producers, for JBS and Cargill and Tyson and Smithfield. Those companies, you know, economies of scale, you know, all of their costs spread across a much larger, you know, profit margin. It's efficient, but it is not great in terms of putting all your eggs in one basket, not to mix my metaphors here.
So we all know that these plants are dangerous places to work, even when there isn't the risk of a virus spreading. What are the working conditions like in these meat processing plants that have made them a place for coronavirus to spread so quickly and easily?
Well, the lines are very fast, and they've gotten faster and faster over recent years through legislation. And people are really elbow to elbow on either side. And then, you know, there's someone across from you 3 feet away. So it's really hard to social distance in those kind of environments. It's much easier if you work for Unilever in a factory that makes salad dressings or something like that. It's a little easier to spread people out on the line. You're going to slow it down, but it's easier to do that. If you're on a line that's cutting beef, you're making a cut with your knife, and then it goes to the next person, and they're making their cut. It's wet, it's fast. There's enough variation in terms of carcasses that it's hard to automate. There's not as much kind of robotics or automation as you might think because of the very slight variations there are animal to animal.
It's interesting. You said something that it's faster through, it's been made faster through legislation. How so?
Well, the lobbying groups for beef, pork, chicken have really worked in recent years to have legislation that allows for faster line speeds because it's more lucrative. And, you know, human rights groups have pushed back saying there's a lot more injury and accident on the job if you have this, you know, these line speeds. And then in terms of food inspection or in terms of food safety, you know, it's much, much harder to make sure that everything is copacetic and that animal looks super healthy and everything is right if you're having to look at, you know, 50 in a minute kind of thing. So it's a problem that's been brewing for a while, and it's really kind of come to its effulgence here because of COVID-19. And, you know, some of it is also lack of PPE, or, you know, you're in a work environment where it's handwork, you know, so it's hard to be all suited up, and there are impediments there. And then you have people, a lot of times not native English speakers, who may not advocate for their own rights as effectively as they might in other kind of circumstances. And then after work, everyone's in the locker room together, changing out of their clothes or in the break room or whatever. So you have a lot of commingling of people on different, you know, from different groups.
Where's OSHA?
Well, you know, it's a lot of stuff to oversee. So yeah, certainly OSHA is taxed at this moment.
My guest is Laura Riley. She is a food industry reporter for The Washington Post. We're talking about all the different issues up and down the food supply chain. So President Trump invoked the Defense Production Act that happened back on April 28th and classified these meat processing plants as critical infrastructure. So first of all, let's just in the most apolitical terms, why?
Well, it's interesting. So the Sunday before this happened, I think it happened on a Monday or Tuesday. So the couple days before, Tyson took out a full page ad in the New York Times, the Washington Post, and an Arkansas paper to say the meat industry is in crisis. You know, there's a lot of money involved. These are very wealthy companies, probably big supporters. And they were basically saying the system is falling apart. You need to do something. And, you know, I think that there's a consumer confidence thing. You know, when you go to the grocery store and there are holes in the meat section, or you go to Costco and it says two per person. I mean, we haven't had rationing, that kind of thing, since World War II. So it does create an aura of panic to think about supply chain disruptions in meat. So he said that they were critical infrastructure, and that the issue is, though, you can mandate that these meat processing facilities stay open, but you can't mandate that the workers come back and that they feel comfortable, or, you know, that they're mm-hmm. not out sick or just out, you know, fearing for their safety and well-being. So that's the limiter right there, is having the workers to do the jobs.
What's been the impact of all this on plant-based meats and other meat substitutes that were really starting to gain huge popularity in the past year?
Well, their sales have been great. You know, you think basically it was the biggest story for a while, you know, in terms of the food industry. And I wrote countless stories about plant-based meat in 2019. So they had incredible momentum going into this. It's taken a little bit of the wind out of the sails just because no one really wants to talk about anything but COVID-19. However, sales of plant-based meat have really increased, whether it's Impossible or Beyond or even kind of the old line, the Tofurkies or the Boca Burgers or whatever. I think people are a little bit more nervous about the provenance of their food and a little bit more nervous about food safety. And I think that it's a logical thing to turn to things like that. The question will be is that on the horizon before all of this happened, cell cultured meat was kind of gearing up to enter the marketplace, and it'll be unclear for a while whether that is going to be on schedule or if that'll get pushed back.
Can you describe what cell cultured meat is?
So this is meat that's basically, I mean, it sounds sci-fi, you know, so you basically take a punch biopsy the size of a sesame seed from a living chicken or cow or whatever, and that animal goes on to live another day, and you take that biopsy and you grow it in a petri dish. So it's kind of in vitro meat that is grown outside the body. And you're kind of creating tissue in a lab environment that can be, that is meat, that is bioidentical to meat that is born. And it removes the cruelty and, you know, a lot of food safety risks in terms of salmonella or E. coli or those kinds of things. So this was kind of coming, it was almost like the plant-based meat, the really kind of the meat that has great, you know, verisimilitude, like Impossible Burger, that was kind of the preamble to this next stage of you know, non-traditional ranching and farming.
That does sound like the beginning of a couple of horror movies I've seen, I have to say.
I think we've seen that movie.
Seen that movie. My guest is Laura Riley. Yeah. She's a food industry reporter for The Washington Post. We talked about conditions in meat processing plants. What are working conditions like for farm workers in terms of health and COVID?
Well, I was actually on a call Friday with Andrew Zimmern and a bunch of people who are concerned about farm workers. So there are a lot of pre-existing problems that make the farm workers, especially the kind of migrant workers or the immigrant workers that do a lot of the work in our fields, that make them perhaps more vulnerable. Some of that is poor nutrition, you know, not having the irony is that a lot of times the people who pick our food are not eating that food, don't have the money to eat that food. They often live together in, you know, a large number in a small space, so it's really easy to pass things back and forth. Again, language barriers can be problematic. So a lot of those H-2A visas that are given to migrant workers that are, you know, they're just gearing up now, right? And in California, a lot of the crops mm-hmm. are just kind of starting. So that is kind of the next population that a lot of experts think may be very vulnerable to this if there is a kind of a big second wave.
My guest is Laura Riley, reporter for The Washington Post. We're talking about all the disruption in the food chains. We'll talk about grocery stores right after the break. This is All of It. I'm Allison Stewart. My guest this hour is Laura Riley, who reports on the business of food and the food industry for The Washington Post. She is walking us through all of the different issues that are in the food supply chain. Let's talk about grocery stores. That's what most of our listeners in this area, anyway, engage with in terms of that link on the chain. From what we've been describing, you know, people have described going to stores, and you mentioned it, we really haven't had food shortages or rationing since World War II, but you go in and there are certain things that are just difficult to find. Some people can't find milk. Some people can't find flour. Are these shortages because of consumer behavior, or is this a supply chain issue?
Well, so early on, let's just go back to like towards the beginning of March. It was irrational panic buying. It was hoarding. It was, in many cases, hysterical baking. You know, we all kind of, small behavior changes grow into these big ripples in supply chain. It's kind of the, you know, the butterfly effect in chaos theory. So if you are buying way more food much less frequently, which we mostly did, it's much harder for retailers to predict what you're going to do. You know, we had these strange runs on things. So about a month after most of us went into to sheltering in place, there was a huge run on hair dye because no one had their hair cut or dyed in a month. So, but that, those kinds of things were very difficult for retailers to predict. So that's why early on you saw some holes. It's hard to spin on a dime and double down on your orders. But subsequently, a lot of the holes that we started seeing were because of massive changes in where humans were eating. So I'll just give you an example. Flour is a great one. So for the past 7 to 10 years, there's been a steady decline in how much flour we buy for home consumption. And that's, so maybe that's carb phobia. Maybe we're just baking less, whatever. So a lot less. Most of the flour is bagged in these 50-pound bags. And so it was sitting there, basically. So from, you know, kind of name any of the big flour companies, you know, from the boutique kind of King Arthur, you know, down to kind of, you know, Pillsbury, whatever. So they don't have infrastructure to take those 50-pound bags slotted for food service, bring them back, slit them open, repackage them. You know, it has to be profitable to do that, and they have to have the manpower to do that. And we're starting to see some of that happening. But so some of it is the sizes that we purchase. On the meat side, interestingly, there's this whole concept called carcass utilization. So for home use, I don't know if we're cheap or we're not confident in our own cooking abilities. We buy the cheap stuff at home. We buy ground beef and chuck and whatnot. The sirloins and the strips and the ribs and the tenderloins, those all go to food service. And those we have, you know, a huge number of right now because it's not stuff that we tend to buy for home use. Seafood, I mean, huge sectors of the seafood industry almost entirely depend on food service and restaurants. You know, oysters have fallen to like 0% of sales because none of us, I think we're all terrified of stabbing ourselves in the palm, but none of us are shucking oysters at home. So there are these, sometimes it's a mismatch of where we eat things. So, you know, seafood, we're eating a lot of canned tuna right now. We're eating zero fresh tuna.
I'm curious about this, that the at least one statistic, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, that April saw the largest increase in grocery prices in the last 50 years. Are there particular products that are driving this?
Well, yeah. So meat, eggs, that was a 4.3% increase, 1.5% increase for fruit and veg, 2.9% increase for cereal and baked goods. And that's the sharpest. I mean, that I think that the cereal one is the sharpest increase we've seen since they started doing this measurement, you know, in like 1919. So, and set against the backdrop of the consumer price index overall for the month of April was down 0.8%. So that's a real market increase in grocery prices. And some of it is just, as I said, you know, we're eating, in the past couple of years, we've spent more money in food service. We've outsourced the production of our food more than we have spent in grocery stores. And so all of a sudden that has completely been turned on its ear, you know. So now we are eating the vast majority of our calories and spending the vast majority of our money at the grocery store. And there, as a consequence, there have been some run-ups in price.
We've talked about the big corporate players in this, like Tyson. What about small producers of cheese and other specialty items? What challenges are they facing?
Well, cheese is a personal interest of mine, and it's tragic because a lot of the boutique cheese producers, they sell in high-end grocery stores where they cut, you know, wedges for you, and, you know, you have a lot of interaction. A lot of those places are closed still, or the cheese counters are closed still. We're eating a lot of cheese, but it's, you know, block cheddar and not the super boutique-y stuff. And then a lot of that is sold into food service. You know, I did a story the other day on Point Reyes blue cheese in Northern California. And, you know, they're just right off the bat, they saw 50% of their sales disappear overnight, you know, the second or third week in March. And the distributors and wholesalers saying, can you take the cheese back? You know? So I think we're going to see a lot of problems in that arena for the small producers. So for meat, you know, let's say you are a cattle rancher who sells to Nyman Ranch or for, you know, one of the kind of high-end producers. You know, your animals are fine. They're still on the field. They're doing what they do. You know, they're getting a little extra time. But at a certain point, they're too big, you know, for like a pig. If you're raising pigs, at a certain point, they are too big to be slaughtered. They don't fit in the slaughter apparatus. So you do have a real limited window. You can't just hold your animals indefinitely. And that's why we've seen, you know, this is just so horrible, but we've seen depopulation in terms of chickens and pigs in the millions, you know, and by that I mean they're euthanized because there's no processing facility for them. So that the bottleneck is creating these horrible experiences for farmers where they've had to, you know, kill their animals prematurely and basically compost them.
Vegetarians and vegans listening to this across the area have their
are
hands
not
up.
Like this conversation one they're bit.
Or they're saying, we told you, we see, we told you. That's another conversation for another day. My guest is Laura Riley, food industry reporter for The Washington Post. Now, obviously, during this conversation, you're talking about all this glut of food, and it can't get where it needs to go, and people are dumping food. Yet we have this incredible food insecurity across the country. In San Antonio, one food bank in San Antonio went from serving 60,000 meals of people a week to 120,000. We've seen lines of people in cars in Pennsylvania waiting for food banks to open. Has anyone responded or figured out a way to make this connection between this glut of food and this incredible need?
Well, I'm happy to say that the USDA has done exactly that. So Friday, they launched this Farmers to Families Food Box program. And this was we talked before about that $19 billion that was given to farmers, and $3 billion of that is direct purchase of product. So that's that part. So they've awarded the contracts for $1.2 billion worth of product. And it's going to be these boxes, basically kind of touchless boxes that can be loaded directly into the trunk of your car at a food bank. And there are five different categories for these boxes. There's one that's fresh fruit and veg, one that's kind of mixed dairy products, so milk, cheese, shredded cheese, yogurt, etc. One that's pre-cooked pork and chicken products, one that's a combination of those, and then one that's just fluid milk. And so as of Friday, they just started rolling this out. And you know, it's a little too early for the food banks to give a thumbs up or thumbs down, but it's a pretty innovative, pretty ambitious public-private project that is supposedly a win-win-win, meaning that the farmers benefit by having some of their surplus taken up. The distributors, the middlemen who've been idled because of, you know, restaurant closures will have something to do and have some money in their pocket. And then this enormous uptick in the food insecure people at the food banks will get some food that they can use immediately, you know, in a contact-free method.
Before I let you go, I do want to ask you about restaurants, because you were a food critic for many years. And we've seen, especially in New York City, I'm sure where you are, just the incredible decimation of restaurants. There was one restaurant a couple actually in New York, who have made this shift of becoming like boutique grocery stores, like actually just selling the goods themselves rather than the meals. What long-term changes do you anticipate as a result of this disruption of the food chain? Like, just once we really come out of it, I shouldn't say long term. I actually want to know when we come out of it, in the months and maybe year after we come out of this.
I wish I were super optimistic. So I've talked to a lot of restaurateurs who say the payroll protection program, the PPP, is really ill-suited to restaurants, because the money that they got, the forgiveness of the loan is predicated on having 100% of your full-time employees back. And if restaurants in a lot of state are mandated to be at 25% capacity or 50% capacity, they can't support 100% of their former employees. The clock starts as soon as they sign that paperwork. In a lot of cases, in a lot of states, they've signed the paperwork, but the restaurants aren't allowed to be open yet. So we're going to see, you know, we are already, they're anticipating that 30% of restaurants will be permanently closed because of this. Just that they can't, it's untenable to have been closed for 8-10 weeks. They've got their rent, they've got debt to their distributors that they haven't paid off yet. So people are anticipating huge bankruptcy and permanent closures in restaurants. But I think there's likely to be another round that restaurants will open up. But, you know, this is a restaurant, or this is a margin issue. You know, restaurants have, you know, they operate on 5-7% margins. So if you're saying, hey, you know, restaurateur, now you have to operate at 50% capacity for the foreseeable future, there's just no way to make the math work. We're definitely going to see, and as we've seen this past year prior to COVID-19, we've seen a market uptick in takeout and delivery, and the kind of the rise of the ghost kitchen. So an offsite kind of commissary kitchen or a you know, warehouse kitchen where you're not, you know, basically just services delivery. I think that is something that we're going to see a lot more of as restaurants try to kind of figure out a new way forward.
Laura Riley is the food industry reporter for The Washington Post. Laura, thank you so much for sharing your reporting with us. We really appreciate it.
Oh, it was great to be here. Thanks so much.